Blog Talk Radio.
Educating black women about her story from all schools of thought. Radio, dedicated to black women and the study of who and what we are. Sadonic Chemistry is a supplier of natural and complementary ingredients used in skincare, hair care, aromatherapy, massage, spa products, herbal preparations, and soap making. We also offer a selection of spiritual supplies, clothing, accessories, natural body scrubs, and herbal mixtures for your beauty and wellness needs. We strive for superior quality products and exceptional customer service. Our natural products and other ingredients are sourced from the most reputable origins and produced in the greenest manner possible. Our products and botanical ingredients are offered in a wide variety of sizes and quantities, to allow you to purchase as much or as little as you need. Feel free to browse our diverse selection or contact us to schedule a salon or spa appointment in our newly renovated Beauty and Wellness Center located in Richmond, Virginia. Visit us at divinechemistry.com or call us at 804-627-0277. Support the Nubian Archaeological Project today. Visit AncientNubianCities.com and make a donation or purchase in search of the Creatrix DVD. Your support allows this project to continue.
Peace and blessings. You are listening to Black Womaniverse Radio. This is your host, Seek Wisdom, also known as Tara. Just want to say peace and blessings to everyone who is out there. If you are listening to us on Facebook, come on over to our chat room at blogtalkradio.com/Black Womaniverse. So we can see you there in the chat room. And also, I'm going to go ahead and open the lines. I have a very, very, very important sister who is an archaeologist. I can't even speak right now. Who is an archaeologist? And she is going to come with us. This will be her fourth or fifth time here on Black Womaniverse to discuss her Nubian archaeological project. And today's show is not just for conversational purposes. Today's show is to actually support her by clicking on the donate button, which can be found at www.AncientNubianCities.com. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and open the line. How are you, Nubia?
I'm doing fine, Sister Seek Wisdom, Tara.
I'm excited today about the radio show, the telethon that we are doing here. This is the first on the show here, but this is very important that we come together and, you know, talk about your field, what it is that you do, and how we can support your efforts. So we're also going to talk about the DVD, In Search of the Creatrix. I have seen it, and it has a lot of great information in it. So I do urge everyone to, you know, purchase the DVD for the information, but more importantly, to support your archaeological project. So
thank you,
Tara. Most of us know who you are. But just for the general audience, I'm going to go ahead and ask the question I ask all the time. Who is Nubia Warford?
Nubia Warford is a sister from our Detroit community and from the African American community, who decided to do my life's desire to become a cultural scientist, otherwise known as an archaeologist. But that's too finite of a term, so I use Dr. Marimba's Ani's term, cultural scientist, because I'm actually researching the entire culture, specifically the culture of ancient Nubia in the Sudan, in northern Sudan. I'm on an archaeological site outside of Qabashia. I am in the process of trying to gain support for that in the form of really just information today. And Sister Tara, you've definitely been a much-needed asset for that, because that's just the part that I just don't do as well as I should do. And right now I have a lecture in Detroit today at 5 o'clock, as a matter of fact. I don't know if you knew that, Sister Tara. At 5 o'clock at 19011 Livernois in Detroit, In Search of the Creatress. As I've been doing my research, I just keep on running into things that the image of the of women in the position of the Most High. And when I was studying the queens of ancient Nubia, most of them were what people would call a cult, but it was just really a religious order, or believed in the believed that Aset was the Most High. And so as I kept on studying, I found out about the mistresses, which are called Nefet and Waret, which are the snake goddesses, which are sometimes also that symbol of the snake is used to represent Neith in earlier forms. And so we know that the sister was the Earth Mother, and worshipped as the Most High. And at the period of time when both of those civilizations, even of ancient Egypt, were in its most highest and productive times, were when the sister goddesses were in the worship, in the height of the worship hierarchy. So that's who I am, and I've been had this desire since I was 7 years old. Went to school, and just now that my daughter is grown up, and my stepson is getting ready to graduate from high school, and my other son is, you know, totally grown. So, you know, it's just a time for me to go ahead and delve off and do what I can to illuminate and enlighten and add to the piece of the puzzle and encourage others to help put this unknown information together.
Now, I want to today pretty much focus on what is the background of archaeology. How does this info get to us? Because I'm a researcher. I study a lot of different things, including archaeology, and I understand the information that's given to me in the book form, but I've never been out in the field obtaining this primary research. So I want to share with our listeners exactly what goes into getting this information that's in the books and in the documentaries and in the articles that we read, because sometimes we don't understand how this information is obtained and how it gets to us and how much hard work goes into it and the fact that it actually needs to be supported. So that's what we want to gear today's show about. So I'm going to go ahead and get into that. First, I find this is a very integral piece of it. What piqued your interest in archaeology? Why is this your field of study? Why do you have such passion for it?
I started being interested in archaeology, like I said, when I was 7 years old. So, digging the dirt in my backyard like many people did when they were kids collecting rocks, that piqued my interest because these rocks told a story about what existed before we were here. So the kinds of rocks, it told what was there. So I began to read about what I thought was archaeology, was paleontology, actually. It was dinosaurs and then people. And then I went to the library and I said I wanted to be an archaeologist. And I read The Treasures of King Tutankhamun, which I didn't know at the time that he was Nubian as well. And his things that were found that were over 4,000 years old piqued my interest, and from then on I knew what my study and research would be, because these things were historically, you know, these great civilizations, these beautiful things, the beautiful life that people had, you know, over 4,000 years ago. Even as a child, I said, you know, we these people are living better than what I think that we're living. And so that's what piqued my interest, and so I think it's as I've gotten older, I've learned that these people's accomplishments, especially black women's contributions to the world, have been ignored, deleted, unknown, even lied about to us. And so it's about bringing truth to the world history books, because, you know, to say that the people in Kemet were Caucasian is just not the truth. I mean, if it were the truth, you know, it's okay, you know, whoever they were, but it's just not the truth. And to say that the architecture in Great Zimbabwe was brought, the castle building was brought from Britain, is just not the truth. Saying that the people in ancient Nubia were primitive and didn't know how to do this and that and the other, when they had running out water, were doing surgeries. Even their culture is much older than people say it is. It's probably upwards of 100,000 years old. So it's just about bringing the truth back to us.
All right. Now, my next question is, how, you know, what steps does it take to be able to find an excavation site and legally excavate? Because you can't just walk up to a country that you're unfamiliar with their culture. You can't just walk up, take a shovel, and start digging, and whatever you find is yours. What steps do you have to go through, and how hard is it to find these sites and then legally be able to excavate there? What's the process?
Wow. Tell us a little bit. That's a big question. Get ready for this long answer. First of all, you have to get there. You have to, put your money down, pay your ticket, get over there, get your visa, which to Sudan, it's no easy feat to get a visa to Sudan. They only give a few people in the country. Since I've established a relationship with universities and the museums and things like that, I most likely can get a visa. Then you have to get there. Then you have to find an archaeological site that you think is worth it. We had ground-penetrating radar done. Sometimes it's done with aerial infrared photography, and that's not free. That's a couple of $1,000 to rent an airplane, fly over the place, then take cameras, then get the pictures developed and find out what areas are available, then go back to the museum and obtain a license, which is $750 to obtain a license to dig. Every year you have to obtain this license. And then you go to the area. I'm on a team of people, and my excavation site is just not totally me. I'm on a team of people. I'm the only African American. I'm working with Dr. Richard Loben, who's an anthropologist. I'm working with some people from Italy. I'm working with people from Russia. Of course, the Sudanese people are involved, the National Museum, and the supervisor of the National Museum. So it's an international team of archaeologists and anthropologists. We have to get a place to stay. Our housing is a village house that has to be rented. We have to buy food every day as we're there. And we also have to pay diggers on the site to help us, because we usually have a three-month digging period where it's not so blazingly hot there. Because if you do it outside of the winter months, then in the morning you wake up to over 100 degrees temperatures, and by the time in the middle of the day it's about 120, 130 degrees temperatures. So we do it at a certain time of the year when it's a lot cooler. And, you know, it might get up to 90, 100 degrees, which is to them is cold weather. In the morning we get up, it could be like 60, 65 degrees. They're wearing winter coats out there, whereas we're wearing little light jackets. You have to pay diggers. We have to have shovels. We have to have equipment. We have to have wheelbarrows. We have to have buckets. We have to pay the people to dig and have the materials we have to have. We dig with small trowels and brushes so that we're not to destroy things. Now, this year, if people go to my Facebook page, it's the Nubia, and look at the excavation site, they'll see where the people dug too fast and they cracked the head of a human skeleton there, because they dug with a hoe. And if you do that kind of thing, then you destroy the find. So all that money that I'm talking about just to get on the site and to get there and housing, and then if I'm staying there, 3 months out of the year doing that, And that's probably about $5,000.
Wow.
For equipment and everything.
And that's just the equipment. That's still, you mentioned that you have to, you know, pay for your own plane ticket to get there as well. So we're talking from Detroit, Michigan.
We're talking
to
about $5,000 to $7,000. $5,000 to $7,000.
Right. Okay. Now, you mentioned you work with a anthropologist. Could you briefly tell us what the difference is between anthropology and archaeology and how those two work hand-in-hand on a excavation site?
Well, anthropology is the study of man, the human existence, and anthropology usually deals with current information on social groups, how people live, different aspects of their living, their tradition, their marriage practices, their birth practices, their death rituals, but people that are currently alive. Archaeology is a branch of anthropology that deals with human civilizations that lived in the past that no longer exist, that people, that you're digging up things and getting evidence of them. So what anthropology, of course, has the benefit of, it has the benefit of you being able to talk to living people about the culture, whereas archaeology, you're making theories about, pretty much guessing hypotheses and theorizing over how the people lived, and you're filling in the blanks and how they lived, what their community looked like, what the civilization was like, based on the material culture that you dig up.
Right. So, in essence, if it were not for anthropologists and archaeologists, we would not be able to look back into the past civilizations or any social groups and be able to tell, you know, what happened. Has our civilization declined? Has it, you know, increased? Has our technology changed? We don't know anything about where we come from or who the past, who were here in the past, if we don't have the anthropologists and archaeologists who are discovering this information.
Yep. Yeah, they do help to let us know what is going on historically, because it's very important. We get people that always have the question, well, what does that have to do with us now? It has a lot to do with us now. Psychologically, everyone has a motherland. Everybody has a homeland. The people that came to the United States, we call they're proudly mentioning all the time in the founding fathers, the founders of the United States, which their mother country was England, or what we would call Britain now. So, you know, if you don't have that that connection to your culture, which many African Americans black people born in America, because many people born here really don't respect or want to have connection to Africa. They don't have any pride in it. They think that Africa is a primitive culture, not developed, doesn't have history, doesn't have culture because of what they've been taught in schools. Now I think Africa is pretty much not really taught in the schools. And before times, our parents and our grandparents, they were taught that Africa didn't have any history or culture. So it makes a person psychologically not be proud to be a black person, a person of dark skin, and want people to, and then forces the people to want to be like something else that has some culture, that has some history. And, you know, it speaks a lot to the assimilation process, that people would rather assimilate to something else because they don't see themselves as having their past, having anything to contribute to the world at all.
All right. Now, how does an archaeologist or archaeologist get funding for excavation and research? You mentioned on average you're looking at about $7,000, and that's just a minimum to be able to do your part in the archaeological excavation that you're participating in. So how does an archaeologist get funding for excavation? I'm sorry, what did you say?
No, go ahead. You're clarifying it for me.
Okay,
right.
How do you obtain that funding? Because most people that I speak with, they assume that because you're an archaeologist or anthropologist and you are in the sciences, you would automatically get a check cut from, you know, a museum or a governmental entity, and that's how you would pay your salary, and that's how you would fund this project. Does it work like that? Is it that easy?
Well, it works like that for a finite group of individuals, but not most of us. I mean, particularly my personal thing. I'll tell you historically. Historically, archaeology was a rich white man's game. You get these names like Kennedys, the Burtons, the Rockefellers, seeing people that were going out doing pot hunting, the Rhodes, doing pot hunting, treasure hunting, looking for old treasures from a long time ago. Some of them developed into, you know, quite good scientists where, you know, they were really trying to undig the cultural aspects of archaeology and really not just trying to deal with valuable materials that they find out of the ground from ancient times. But those guys funded themselves because they had they were independently wealthy. Their families were independently wealthy, most of it, of course, off of slave labor and things like that. But the fact is they had their own money. So there are a few grants available, usually on the master's degree, PhD level, and you have to be affiliated with some university to get them and or affiliated with a university to get them. And they're very difficult to get. There are not a lot of people giving grants for archaeology, especially for ancient Nubia. The people that are getting money are heads of departments, of university departments from Europe and from the United States, but they're on the PhD, master's degree level, and, you know, they just have a history where, you know, these institutions have a history of borrowing, and they have a relationship with the borrowing and getting these type of resources. So myself, I have done some fundraisers in the city of Detroit. I started like in 2004 doing fundraisers, and I did them up into 2008. And I did fundraisers, and people came to them. Lectures had many people raise a bit of money. And and got a plane ticket and was able to pursue. There, I'm not funded by any museums. I'm not funded by any wonderful philanthropists. I've had people give me a couple hundred dollars in donations, towards my ticket. I've had the fundraisers to get money for my first ticket. Of course, I've been back twice since then. My beautiful husband tries to help me a little bit, but, you know, he's not in the Rockefeller family either, and he does it. So I really much touch do this in with my own whatever money I raise, and however I make a living, I just cut out a little bit to do this. And right now, I'm not, I don't have a job. I was laid off from the museum as the economy changed in 2008. And I went and obtained my scholarship, and so right now I'm pretty much relying on fundraisers and things like that, and in the sales of the DVD and the lectures, and looks like that's it for right now until I get enough to produce some educational materials. That's what the goal is, to produce some educational materials to share with children primarily, and do the lectures for adults, so that we can get children interested in history and archaeology and anthropology, so that this site, you know, when I die, I don't want this project to die. I want to have cultivated a group of young people that are going to keep this going on.
Right, and that's very important in keeping our youth, connected with, you know, the things that you're doing with the excavation site and everything. It's very important to keep our children connected with that, so they don't feel as though this has nothing to do with them and it doesn't matter.
Right.
So,
and many of them feel that way.
Right. Now, in listening to you speak about, you know, it pretty much has been, archaeology has pretty much been a field where rich people, mainly rich white men, you know, that have money would finance their own archaeological digs. for the purposes of treasure or what have you, it's interesting. That brings me right to the another topic that's directly connected with this. You know, as a researcher in the field, I research a lot of things, but in terms of archaeology and history or what have you, as a researcher, that field has become a little bit stagnant to me in terms of new information, and let me explain. It's not due to a lack of new discoveries, but more so a deficiency in the honesty and the approach of the information that we already have and the new information coming out.
And you're right.
I'm saying this mainly because I look at, you know, the documentaries that I look at, the books I read, and I find out that it's a lot more information out there that is plain and simply not being shared, not being explored, and pretty much not coming out to the public. And a lot of this information that's not being shared with the public is some of it, not all of it in totality, but I would say about 50 to 75% of the information that's not being shared is being discovered by women archaeologists. Or if it's not being discovered by a female archaeologist, it's something about women that's being discovered that will, if it came out, is going to challenge what has already been accepted as the story of history that has already been written.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of research going on. There's one specific discovery that is like you just described, the discovery of Taharqa being a lot further south in southern Sudan than thought. And this discovery was made by archaeologist Julie Anderson from Britain. And she, expanded the parameters of a dynasty and the empire of the dynasty that Taharqa actually was in southern Africa. Now, what that means is that there's much more to be discovered, and the women bring another different aspect. Women think a lot differently than men. So really, for any field of study to really be balanced and have a whole perspective, women need to be involved and men need to be involved, because it gives a whole perspective on things, gives it that balance. And I think that's what the ancient people in Kemet understood that too, that it needs that woman's eye on it. And that might be why they rose the woman to the Most High, because they understood that, and you need that keen woman's eye on it, that nurturing eye on it.
Now, it's just, like I said, I mean, it's also to the point where a lot of information that has come out, or like I watched this documentary, I forget which particular excavation site or which continent it was on. I believe it was a place in South America. It may have been Peruvian. I'm not sure. But I was watching this documentary, and this woman was talking about this information that she discovered back in the 50s. And when she came out with this information, it completely challenged and would have almost nearly shattered everything that the previous archaeologists had written about what was going on in this particular time frame and in that particular era, that in terms of the artifacts that she had discovered. And they pretty much blackballed her and made it so that she could not work in that field anymore. They made other people feel as though she was crazy because she was the information she had discovered, the artifacts and the evidence that she had discovered, completely went against what they were saying, and they did not want to be challenged.
They do. The academia does stuff like that. If it's out of the parameters of what they've been teaching or what they think, it's just ludicrous to them. I mean, it's ludicrous to them for you to talk to people now and ask them about their oral history and their traditions about a civilization, any civilization, and them to relate it back to 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. They said things change and it's not the same and this, that, and the other, but there are remnants of the same things, whether they're 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, especially in Northeast Africa. Northeast Africans do not change what they do very much. They are very resistant to changing traditions and the way they do things. You can step back in some of these communities and look at the side of the pyramids and these texts and these stela that have pictures of, you know, how people functioned 5,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago, and see the same things going on. So why couldn't that, the oral history, also have remained a bit the same? So exactly. Some of the things that I'm talking about would be, especially by the schools of thought, in the American school of thought, especially the your European schools of thought, it's just not done that way. And in the women, oftentimes they'll bring other things to the table. It was actually five white anthropologists that, women anthropologists, I must add, that discovered that, that we have the DNA of about four or five different women. And African women in our blood, and they did, they traced that history back. That was not, that did not escape from anyone's mouth until the women became involved. And, you know, because they know that DNA is transferred from woman to woman, so they traced back many people from many different cultural groups, and they found out that, I mean, that information would have never gotten released had it been left up to the same type of gender that has been dominant over the anthropological and archaeological fields.
Now,
Tara?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Support the Nubian Archaeological Project today. Visit ancientnubiancities.com to make a donation or purchase In Search of the Creatrix DVD. Your support allows this project to continue.
Hello?
Yes, Nubia, I'm still here. I'm not sure why you couldn't. Can you hear me now? Nubia, can you hear me? Nubia? Hello? Okay, I see in the chat room that they can hear me. I'm not sure why you can't hear me, Nubia. Okay, looks like her line temporarily disconnected, so hopefully she will get a chance to call back in just a moment. So we're going to go ahead and take this opportunity to go on break, and we'll be right back.
I am a boisterous river. I am a mountain spring.
If you don't recognize my presence, I am here. That was Jill Scott. I love, love, love that song. All right, let's see if we can get Nubia back on the line. Nubia, are you there?
Yeah, just went out.
Not sure what happened, but we just took the opportunity to take a brief break.
Mm-hmm.
And
support the Nubian Archaeological Project today. Visit ancientnubiancities.com and make a donation or purchase in search of the Creatrix DVD. Your support allows this project to continue.
All right, with that being said, let's go ahead and speak a little bit about your DVD, which I was very excited and ecstatic to, you know, listen to and watch. And we're not going to give away all of the information that's in the DVD because it would take too long. It's really got some really good images in it. It has very good information. Definitely go and purchase the DVD. And today it is $20. I think it's only $25, but it'll be $20 for everyone who purchased it today. Is that correct?
Yes, it is correct. It's only $20 purchase, and all, as you said, all of the money goes towards the expenses incurred while doing travel, research, and excavations for the Nubian Archaeological Project.
All right. Now, the title, how did you come up with the title? I mean, I can tell looking at the information exactly where the title comes from, but In Search of the Creatrix, what inspired that title? And just talk about that a little bit.
Well, I thought that every thing has a feminine, the title, the creator, could have a feminine bend to it, so I created the name Creatrix, T-R-E-S-S, so people would know that the creator could have been a creatrix, because creator implies a male deity. And so I wanted to just be specific, and in search of that deity, that feminine spirit or that feminine deity, I've been going back in time and searching and see where she's been and the trail. I'm following her trail. So In Search of the Creatrix, that's where I got that from. And then, of course, off the goddess thing, because sometimes when people talk about goddesses, they think that the goddess is a lower form of a deity, and I wanted it to be as high as possible in the hierarchy of religious orders and belief systems and things. And incidentally, even though this has a religious type of bend to it, this is just factual evidence that I'm able to trace through primary as well as secondary research. The evidence I show from the archaeological dig that I did myself, as well as information that I've got from several resources, because the most thing that people foam in when they have comments is they say, I've never heard this before. Where did you get this information? So I said, this is not new information, and then I give them a litany of resources that is just not off the top of my head, but I do plan to add more to it.
All right, yes, you have part two of this DVD coming up, so I can't wait to order that so that I can see that as well when you finish with that. Now, you mentioned, and I hope I heard you correctly on the DVD, but I think you mentioned something about a tomb of offset.
Mm-hmm.
Could you speak about that?
Well, there was, and nothing has come out about it. There was because many of the sarcophaguses have wings, a person in the sarcophagus, that's the casket, the coffin, where it's gold, gilded gold coffin with some semi-precious stones in it that have winged figures on it. But they found a prominent winged being buried. It's been probably about a year and a half ago. Once they found this artifact in Egypt, in the West Bank of the Nile, which is totally burial grounds, and they just found it, and they remarked that they found this winged goddess, burial of a winged goddess, and they've mentioned no more about it. So I was just like, I don't want any parts of that one. You know, they need to leave that one alone. it's interesting that nothing has come out about it. Sometimes when you hear about these archaeological digs and you try to research and go back and find the report of it, you can't find the report anymore, any information on it, because many times when they report that they've found something, it's actually something that's been found 15 years earlier or more, and they have to perfect their presentation about the find to do more research on it. So that's literally all I know about that one. I just they didn't even say it was Osset. It's possibly Osset.
Oh, okay, okay.
Let me add to that too. There's also you know, people have been trying to claim Osset's origin, and so we're not exactly sure her exact origins. Anyway, we think it's Nubian, and then there's also people who think she was a Twa, and then there's people who say she's an Anu. So we just know that she's from the south.
All right. Now, it's interesting to talk about, you know, our rich history as African people, and how our knowledge and the worship of our deity spread from Africa to other places. But you put a different spin on it when you can actually go to these other places and locate it and be able to see how mm-hmm. the worship of Osset, also known as Isis, got to, mm-hmm. you know, Crete and other areas. Could you talk a little bit about how the worship of the goddess got to, you know, went to other areas from out of Africa, how it migrated to other areas, and a little bit of that evidence supporting it. Like I said, not too much, because we want to leave some information for the evening.
Right, right. Okay, well, one way it traveled, because it traveled down the Nile River. It followed the path of the Nile River. The Nile River going from south to north instead of north to south. And so the Nile River actually, you know, has, you know, tributaries and small rivers that branch out to it that go to the Red Sea. The Red Sea, you know, then the people go around from that way and they go in small rivers, and it goes down to India. The Indians were actually doing, I'm talking about East Indians, not Native Americans, were doing trade with Africa during these time periods. So the culture, there was a lot of cultural exchange during that time period. The culture also can travel via the ocean, specifically the Atlantic Ocean, whereas the culture can go around on the drift currents and end up there via traveling sailors, explorers. And wherever people go, they take what they know about them. We know Neat ended up in Crete and throughout the African cultural sphere. And we also know that Neat traveled off Tory Island by African sea movers and went to the northwest coast. And we think the Fomorians, who is a culture there, who are shrouded deep in mystery, are held to, because they're supposed to be sinister forces in Irish mythology. But it can also be that they were black, and anything that's seen as black has sinister forces. And it got intermingled with later with the Tuatha De Danann, which Tuatha De Danann goes back to Danu, Tanu, the Anu, and Neat. Because the culture goes all around. So Osset and Neat are, they're interchangeable at some point in time. It's not that they're the same person, but you'll see the same aspects that Neat has, Sister Osset has too. The deity Osset has too, because those aspects of representation. Iconography means that she is the most, you know, she's the Most High and she's a deity. So we get the same wings and we get Neet, or represented by Neet. We get the same Aset. We get, of course, the wings of Aset, and we get snakes, worn on the crown of the head, and all kinds of things. So how it goes interchanges is that the Africans don't leave out anything. The culture just builds and builds and builds, and there you have the history of the culture materially. Because you see in the iconography, just about you can go back and trace where these things came from, just like I was talking about the two mistresses, Wajet and Sepket. So those two snakes are the protector of the royal seed, which get passed to Neet, get passed up to later Isis, and then Aset, and then, you know, you can follow the culture from the traditions.
Okay. Now, on your, you made a comment about Queen Tee. Now, before I watched your DVD, I watched a documentary, I think it was a National Geographic documentary about, it wasn't Queen Tee. I forget which documentary I watched that had this on there, but they showed a picture of, it was Nefertiti, it was a documentary on Nefertiti, and they showed a picture of Queen Tee, her her mummy. And at first glance, a person who isn't well studied or doesn't know anything about the different phenotypes would assume that was not Queen Tee. Could you talk about the phenotypes and the hair and kind of sort of get into that? Because a lot of people think that only black people have one type of hair, or all of us have a broad nose. And, I mean, you can clearly look around in our neighborhood and see that that's not the case. Could you speak about that and sometimes how you may run into that?
Yeah. Well, because of that, I mean, I think I mentioned that the Ku Klux Klan has a website where they're proving that the people in Egypt and ancient Nubia were Caucasian because they have thin noses and straight hair. Well, if it's mountain regions and the air is cooler, and the desert at night in certain times of the year and certain times in the morning, it's very cool out there, especially in Egypt. When I went to Egypt, we came out in the morning and it was 35 degrees. So these people adjust, their phenotypes adjust according to the climate. So they're having the thinner, longer noses, and they're having the straight hair. The hair follicles close up, open up, and the hair comes out in order that the hair goes closer to your head and protects your head from the cold. So we have everything. And then you have to understand the ancient Nubian, ancient Kemet, which is Egypt, is a metropolis. It's a educational center. There are universities there. So it's attracting all the Africans from all over the continent, as well as people from other European places and Asia. We have people from Asia, Turkey, China, attending these universities at a certain point in time. And, of course, lastly, you get the Greeks and the Romans that eventually, you know, they liked the university so much they wanted to take over the country because they wanted all these attributes and all these accomplishments for their own, even at a time when most of them took the school over. When Alexander took over Egypt, he was illiterate. He couldn't even read. So, that's the history, how things get distorted and transferred, and then people think that that just because the later civilization, the Arabs and the Greeks and the Italians and the Brits and the Serbs and the Greeks and the Romans occupy that area now, they are not the original creators of the people of those pyramids, and the people that lived a long time ago were not only black, as Sheikh Anta Jope did a skin sample of Pharaoh Khufu from the Great Period, he was blue-black. not only black, he was blue black, and those were Shaykhin Tajope's words.
Wow, and that was in his findings that he presented to UNESCO, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And so you get all this, and also let me just add to that, you get all the hair textures too. You know, you get the very tight curly, which we call nappy hair. You get the in between. You get straight hair. You just get everything. I mean, it's black people come in all types of skin colors and everything, as you mentioned. And you know, nobody has a monopoly on certain type of nose and hair.
All right. If you have a comment or question for us, it's Anubia Warford. And give us a call, 646-716-7675, and be sure that you press 1 on your keypad, whether it is you just want to, you know, tell her thank you for the work that she's done, or whether you have a question. Either way, give us a call, 646-716-7675. Now, I wanted to go back on something you mentioned earlier about the type of people that were normally in archaeological studies and research, you know, in the past. Do you think that because in the past there have been, you know, as you stated earlier, rich white men mostly in this particular field, do you think that had an impact on what type of information was being presented and how it was being presented?
Definitely, definitely. Had an impact on that because even though they have the money to research and the money to travel, so their perspective, the reason why anthropology was created, it was to create the supremacy of the Caucasians, specifically the Europeans. And so if that's what you're going out to prove, you're going to just really just publicize anything that you think proves that. You come up with a line of thought that says that you know, that there are two types of people that existed, ape-like and monk and human-like people, and the human-like people developed. If you look at the chart, everybody develops into a white man. So that definitely had something to do with skewing information, leaving out information, misinterpreting information, because they're coming from the European train of thought. And some things they just thought were unfathomable. Just like I mentioned before, they thought Great Zimbabwe was a race of white people that had come and built those castles and the moats and the structures there, as well as, you know, you get those type of ridiculous thoughts, such as Sun City, that the ancient people of southern Africa were of Caucasian origin. So, yes, definitely that it influenced the way and the thinking and the way that the anthropology is taught and shared.
Now, I also want to touch on this. The reason why I pose that question is because I know and I feel that the lack of support does a disservice to finding the unbiased truth, and it's up to our community to support our researchers so that we can go and get more information. I do acknowledge that there are a lot of people of different racial backgrounds that do tell the truth about what they find because they are true archaeologists, but there are also people such as yourself that are, you know, of our race and of our background that are in this field that do not get a lot of support, and they don't always have all of the media play, and their name is not out there in the forefront like that, so they don't get a lot of support and backing. So that's why I pose that question. Our research comes from who we support and or who has the money to do certain things. So I just think that it's very important to realize that by supporting the Nubian Archaeological Project and other projects like hers, we can get more unbiased information because it's us that's supporting it. They don't have an agenda because the text was written out from a some other entity that has a different agenda. So that was the whole point in the last question that I asked. Mm-hmm. Now, I also want to touch bases on, we do have a lot of great researchers, such as Dr. Ben and Dr. John Henry Clark, and as you mentioned, Sheikh Ansar Diop. But I'm going to make this statement, and I want you to add on to it, but I'm going to state it as fact based on what I have reviewed and what I have researched. And personally, by talking to Dr. Ben myself, I'm going to add that in as well. It's important to look at what our, in certain situations, ancestors, because some of these scholars have passed on, some of these researchers have passed on, but we also, Dr. Ben, who's still living, we need to look at their research and their findings as a basis to move forward. We can't just go and refer to their books and leave it as is. There's a lot more information to be discovered, and there's a lot more information that we don't know or that we think. We look at mythology and we look at different things, and we can see how mythology does play a role, and certain mythologies are confirmed when you go and you do certain excavations and certain research. But we cannot just sit on the research that our elders and our ancestors have done. We actually have to take that as a springboard and find out how deep the rabbit hole really goes. Can you touch on that and just add a little to that?
Well, yeah, you pretty much summed it up that Dr. Ben himself is just, you know, has said, I want you to go out and study. I want you to learn this. He didn't know how to study hieroglyphics. He didn't know how to read a lot of the hieroglyphics. He knew how to read Hebrew. And so he's telling people to go and you need to learn the language. You need to learn the language. Dr. Theophile Benga has said you need to learn hieroglyphics. You know, rather than studying what other people have to say, listen to what the ancestors have to say. If you read some lies, you'd rather read the lies the ancestors said than the recent lies. Those people really didn't know, can't tell the truth. And not saying that what they're saying is lies either. I'm just saying that you just really need to do the primary research, because many of those hieroglyphic text hasn't been found, you know. And when they are interpreted and they are written, just going by when I've sat in rooms of people and I'm learning how to read the text too, I'm only on chapter 4 in the hieroglyphics book, because I've been studying for 6 years and I've been going back and forth and going back and forth. It is not easy. I need to have time to research, you know, I don't need any distractions, and I need to sit down and do it. But what I've noticed, and what I've noticed with the people that have studied the hieroglyphics, is that the English translation often leaves out some information. There's a pattern of leaving out information. So we have to be encouraged by our elders and those people who have told us, go and research. You know, just don't do, you know, you can't read Black Man of the Nile and think that was done in 1970 and think that that's all there is to be done. There's plenty other things. There are archaeologists and anthropologists now. One of the greatest historians that I have such a respect for is Manu Ampim, Manuampim. He's also on Facebook. Manu Ampim is one of the most impeccable researchers that I have run across. He is a monster when it comes to research. He checks and rechecks and understands, knows how to read hieroglyphic texts. In fact, I'm a part of his archaeological team that we're going to be going out to do some stuff in Sudan as well. So these are the two teams that I probably will focus on, is Richard Loban's team and Manu Empem's team. And we're going to create, in fact, me and Manu Empem want to be one of the first team of Black anthropologists and archaeologists, because we want to do just what you're talking about. It's time to do more primary research. I'm starting on some. Manu Empem is doing some. Anthony Browder is on an archaeological site in Kemet. And as soon as me and Ampim get established, we're going to invite volunteers to come on in the site. We won't be doing any tours until we get the information straight and get the research straight, because a lot of people just will have you go on those tours because that's their way of making money. That's their bread and butter. But they don't know how to read. Anyone that doesn't know how to read the hieroglyphic text, you mans will not go on a tour with them, because they cannot tell you what it means. It's funny I mentioned that.
Yeah, it's just funny that you mentioned, you know, the doing tours and things and you want to make sure that before that happens, the information is accurate and complete,
right,
in terms of everything that you've discovered. And
mm-hmm.
it's also funny that you mentioned the bread and butter from certain activities, such as tours and things. I find it very important that a person is in a field in which they have passion for and that their research and their fervor to get this information out is because that's what they're passionate about, not just because this is the way I'm going to make money. Now, it's great mm-hmm. to be in a field that you have passion about it and you can get paid for doing what your passion is, but oftentimes it's a situation where people are just doing things just for money and it's not something that they're passionate about. And in that case, information can be misconstrued because then you are giving information out that's catering to the people that pay your bills.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, again, this is where the supporting of projects and services that are based on unbiased truth-seeking. And actually, for example, if I think a certain way or if I think, you know, based on mythology or certain oracle tradition, if I already think this is the case and I'm not true to myself and true to this research, so when I go start digging or finding information out and doing my research, I find that the research and the artifacts go against what I had already thought was the case. If I'm not true to myself, I'm going to still stick to what I already thought no matter what the artifacts state. And so this is the importance of unbiased, you know, scientific evidence to support a hypothesis, which is a guess.
Mm-hmm. So. It's just a guess. And much of the research out there, people have to understand, is a guess. You know, and my intention is to find material evidence that verifies things I'm guessing. And to tell you the truth, the whole lecture I have, at one point in time, I had guessed all those things, and then I found information to verify that my guess was not a guess, that it was a fact.
But see, that's it. It's good to do research and to, you know, read and all of that information so you can be able to have these educated guesses, these hypotheses, and then you get out there in the field and you're able to dig up and verify, you know, okay, I thought this was so, and on such and such date we found this, and based on, you know, A, B, C, and D, this has been verified. This is now a fact versus I just feel, you know. So
Right.
It's very important. I think we have someone on the switchboard with their hand up, 845 area code. So let us know who you are and where you're calling from.
Hey, this is GS Evolution. How's everyone doing today?
Hi, GS Evolution. I'm doing so nice to see it, hear a voice to this.
Yeah. And I'm bringing up, I wanted to ask another question, but the sister, Black Woman, what's how you pronounce your name, sis?
Black Womaniverse.
Nubia? Black Womaniverse.
No. Black Womaniverse, all right. I'm not even looking at the screen right now. I would have looked at it and got it better. But you brought up a point about having your mind made up and then when you do research. And I'm going to try to broaden this out a little bit broader than the archaeological evidence, something more pertinent in general as far as African people. And I just want both of your feedback. And then I have a specific question about the Black woman being God. So, one, do you think is a problem within our communities right now that we have a lot of so-called African-centered black conscious people with their minds made up what is and what isn't African, yet have no evidence to support their hypothesis? And even when you give them contrary evidence, they want to fight you as if what you said is coming from Alexander himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then my follow-up after that, after y'all two answer that, I'm going to talk about the Black woman being God.
Well, go ahead, Black Womaniverse. I know you have a lot to say on that one.
Okay, let me make sure, correct me if I'm wrong on what your question is, because I want to make sure I'm clear on what your question is. Do we think it's a problem in the community in terms of not, I guess you're speaking about in the Afrocentric community in reference to what is African and what's not African and how people don't like to, I guess, look at information that you or other people may present to go to the contrary of what they're trying to describe is or isn't African. Is that pretty much what your question is?
Well, I'm going more or less with what you were saying earlier. In other words, do you think it's problematic now, not just me, but in general, that we're placing ideology above evidence, and that if we're going to liberate ourselves as a people, is that a danger of us not being able to really address any of our historical and current problems?
I mean, it can be problematic, but the bottom line, as I see it, is you cannot change another person's mind. You have to look at where that person is coming from. If that person is coming from a place of knowing this information so they can kind of sort of create a facade about them being better than everybody else on the planet, and you try to present something that is a little bit to the contrary or just add some information and this isn't something they want to agree to, it's going to always be a problem. Versus if you're looking at a person who is open-minded and has an idea about something, and then you present something they may add to and be a little bit different or totally different from it. If that person's open and is a true researcher of truth, they're going to entertain it anyway, even if it totally goes against what they thought. That doesn't mean you're going to be able to change their mind, but it still means they may be able to entertain it. At the end of the day, it still comes down to where that person's mind is and the fact that you nor I can change another person's mind. We're not going to ever be able to change somebody else's mind. It's all about where that person is and whether they want to accept or is ready to accept the information that's put in front of them. Plain and simple.
Well, I guess my response to that is that if someone is going to argue with you without any proof or any fact that, you know, different aspects of culture, history, politics is not African or the way of life is not African without any research, they're not really doing it scientifically. A lot of people say, well, I'm just doing it spiritually and I just know because my spirit tells me. Well, there has to be something that verifies what they're thinking spiritually is correct, because, you know, spirit is negative too. You know, there are negative spirits and positive spirits. So some, you know, there can be some spirits out there that are hiding the truth from you. So you need to have some facts. I mean, the African tradition is something that you can go to people. Most Africans live in all parts of the world, and many of the Africans, though they don't like to talk about it, they understand what their tradition is. They understand their traditional values. So you could, you know, you have living sources that can tell you some of these things. And some people just propose things are African because it's their convenience. I mean, one thing that I think that people do that is not African in Africa. Men don't wear cowrie shells unless it's ceremonial, but here in the African-American men, they wear cowrie shells. Cowrie shells are a feminine symbol that they put on the babies at birth, or they throw cowrie shells. And it's not because they're trying to be disrespectful, it's just they don't know. And I think that that's probably a component of what the argument is, that the people just don't know. They think they know, but they just don't know because they haven't thoroughly researched it.
All right. And now I want to go back to my other question about the lecture with the woman as the creatress, right?
Okay.
How do we, because, like, and I was happy to see a lot of your lectures that I was noticing lately. Can you hear me?
Say that again. You were going in and out.
No. I was happy to see, like, a lot of the interviews lately that I've been witnessing, and it's coming to a head in my head where, okay, and I already kind of knew, so it's kind of confirming what I've been thinking, that the first creator was actually a woman. how do we mm-hmm. begin to make this shift between is this male concept of God back to the feminine in a way that is going to allow ourselves to move our people forward?
You mean, how do you present the information that to bring it back into unity between the sisters and the brothers, basically, so that the brothers accept this as well?
And even
is that
the
what
sisters,
you're saying?
I even see mm-hmm. sisters. I have a sneaking suspicion, not all, but there's a good portion of sisters who I would naturally think will gravitate towards it, but actually reject it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and well, I'm not quite sure why.
Well, because it's new. It's a concept, and the same reason when I would say that you had your other, you posed your other question. They haven't seen any. This is new information to them. They've not heard it before. You have to keep on giving them resources and things like that. My staple resources for this is Ivan Ben Sertima's edited book, Black Women in Antiquity, where Renoko Rashidi has the section, African Goddesses, Mothers of Civilization. He gives plenty enough evidence of, that woman was worshipped tremendously in Africa. I mean, even going far back as Tanzania and the Rift Valley, like I had on that interview that you commented on, in East Central Africa and the Great Lakes region. In the earliest times, she had an encompassing influence and was universally acknowledged as the greatest and ultimate seat of power. She was the giver and the sustainer of life, and it was known all over the African continent. See, what we need to understand is that this breakup of the African continent, Africa was a matrilineal or matriarchal society, period. Period. In the connecting areas, the empires that stretched out far into Asia, and pretty soon I'm going to show how those Asian goddesses number the same African goddesses, and even trace back the transition in the names from when they studied at the university. It's just a lack of knowing. And resisting change is not revolutionary. Revolutionary means change and acknowledgement of change in order that we can be productive people. So if men are talking about they're the ultimate in power just because they have more muscle mass, that's stagnating too. That's stagnating for the brain. And I mean, and this is just history. I mean, even not to me, it's not really dealing with the religious aspects and people's belief system. I'm not even going there. I'm just supplying archaeological evidence saying that the black woman was worshipped as the African woman even before the name Africa was into the minds of anybody, that she's the Earth Mother. And I think if people are resistant to that and they call themselves African-centered, that these things are what is the remnants of Western thought and ideology that's still in our heads, and they reverse the system only to control it. I mean, they reversed everything because they wanted everything opposite, and they wanted everything to point to Europe as the creator of all these things. And if they keep on, these people keep on playing into that, they're doing exactly what was meant to be done, and they're involved in the same oppression of our people in our history as the Europeans are guilty of.
Hmm. Well, I would like to have a go at that question.
Go ahead, Tara.
Well, I'm going to start from a comment that he made, because you touched on quite a few things I was going to mention. I'm going to start with the comment of more women, that he said he runs into a lot more women who have a problem with the idea of a woman being God. And I really think that is very important to understand the impact that women have a problem with it. The question is, why do women have a problem with it? For a long time, women have been told otherwise. And so, yeah, it's accepting something new, but it also has to do with women's empowerment. And when I say women's empowerment, a lot of people, male and female, have a problem with that. It's not about saying specifically that one thing is better than the other or there's a winner or a loser. If the person who is birthing the baby, the person who is giving the motivational support to everybody, if she is not, if she's, and I'm not just speaking from a nurturing and just a mother aspect, because it's more to being a female and being a woman just than being a nurturer and a mother. That's the other thing. Our whole essence has been kind of sort of downgraded to, in certain respects, as just being a mother and a nurturer and the person who cooks meal and things. And I'm not saying that all men do that, so understand the context and what I'm trying to explain here. But if this is the image of who and what a woman is, and then specifically as who and what a black woman is, she does not have an image of herself that equates to something that can be deified. So in her psyche, that is a like, oh, wait a minute, I'm God, wait a minute, what does that mean? Because if you look at these different religions, and religions played a big role in this, religions of all kind, not just one, all kind, most of religions have kind of sort of pointed to her as a specific type of role. And so a lot of us came up as Christian. Some of us came up in certain different religions. And these religions also play a role in kind of sort of downgrading a female and not even allowing her to feel as though she is of reverence or respect in a certain kind of way. So
not kind
that
of, sort of, totally.
Exactly.
Not
I,
totally.
I take the kind of, sort of out, totally. Thank you for correcting me on that. Totally made her not feel worthy of this type of respect. So she's almost kind of sort of like, hold on, wait a minute, I don't know about that. You know, I don't know about that. She don't even know how she feel about it right up front until this type of archaeological evidence and other research can be presented to her and for her to research on her own time. This isn't going to be – this is why I think women need to have that individual time to go off and read and study on their own without input from anybody else telling them what to think, because then if she's given that time, she can kind of sort of build up the self-esteem and the self-confidence and start to look at herself as being worthy of that. And that's going to have to happen on an individual and a personal basis, but it's also going to have to happen on a communal basis as well. And the reason why I say that is because the other thing that plays a role in it, in certain communities and certain arenas, it's also said that we need to not read certain books. This also plays into it. We need to stop limiting, and this applies to male and females in the black community, period. Specifically, I'm going to specifically talk to the conscious community or the African-centric community on this one. We cannot, you cannot tell a people, male or female, to not read books that are not by black authors. And let me explain why. Because if you don't read books that are not by black authors, you are missing out. If you limit yourself to those books, you are missing out on a vast majority of information that could really help all of us out, but also specifically black women and how we look at ourselves as a whole. So we have to stop limiting our research. And not all black people that have good information have written books. So if we just limit it to the books that have been authored by specific people, we're missing out on a lot of information. We're at a point where we can no longer continue to not pay attention to certain information to suit certain people. We've got to do our research on our own, and the women will have to come to it on their own. A sister just presented to her, she has to come to it on her own. It's not going to be a situation where she has to be forced to feel this way by somebody else or doing what some of people in different religious faiths do, kind of sort of come to her as though this is a new religion type thing. She has to come to know who she is on her own without feeling pressure from somebody else. And the other thing I want to put on people, and this will be the last thing I mention in regards to this question, is we need to do some research on egalitarian societies. In an egalitarian society, those are the societies that were referred to as matriarchal or matrilineal. These societies did not dedicate this person is a winner and this person is a loser. It had more to do with a partnership type of society, more so than a dominator and dominating everything. They revered and respect and worshiped the woman as being the image of God here on earth, but also the men were not necessarily treated as, you know, a lot of people, a lot of men, when you talk to them about this particular topic here, they think, a lot of men thinking winners are losers. Not all, but some of them do. And so if they're thinking that the woman is being respected and revered in this way, then this means I'm not shit. And I use that word because that's what a lot of people say. So where does that leave me if the woman is this? You came from her. So it can't leave you as being a pile of something that is non-existent if you are a part of her. And if you look at her as being a part of you, as that which you came from, you revere where you came from, you respect her and you respect yourself. So I think that's all what it comes down to in regards to that particular question from my perspective.
Gia, so we answer your question? I think he's gone. So, yeah, well, you know, and the thing is that, you know, egalitarian societies and how people worshipped, you know, equally, egalitarian societies really just means that the man and woman had equal footing as far as their power and their importance. And even in family life and even as far as political life. But the most important thing is that everything that we really just got to wipe the slate clean and say and pretty much say that 70% of the information brought to us from Western, people from the West about these early Egyptian societies is we could just kind of flip it around. If they say that women were not an important thing, then we can probably look up and find that they were important things. And we could say, that North is on top and South is on the bottom. It depends on your perspective. And Western perspective comes from what they think is good for them. It's not until recently, I'd say into the 1920s on, you get these people that are telling history honestly from what exactly is they're reading from the text, and then they're interpreting the information and write it down best they could, honestly, because anthropology was not created to be honest. It was created to prove white supremacy. So it doesn't mean that you don't study what they said. It's just that take what they always say with a grain of salt, because there are elements in truth. I mean, if people are real, if you listen to a liar, sometimes a liar lies about things so much they forget about the lies they first told, and they tell the truth inside some of the lies they've told and some of the lies they tell after because they forget what they've said. And I think pretty much history is written like that as well. The African-centered scholars definitely give a perspective on it, but sometimes their perspective is not the truth too, because they're going out their way to prove, you know, the Africans did this than the other. You don't have to go out the way to prove Africans did anything better than anybody else. Just tell the truth, because they existed. Their societies were dominant and there more than, you know, 100,000 years before everybody else anyway. So anything they've done is in advance or before, predates anything else. So it's not necessarily necessary not to tell the truth.
All right. Again, our call-in number is 646-716-7675. We have a switchboard full of people. If you have a comment or question, make sure that you press 1 so that Nubia Warfer can speak to you and you can ask her your question or make your comment. And before I check the other line, I just want to remind everyone, too.
Support the Nubian Archaeological Project today. Visit ancientnubiancities.com and make a donation or purchase in search of the Creatrix DVD. Your support allows this project to continue.
All right.
Thank you, Tara. I just got a donation from Anish Sarood, $100 donation. Thank you so much, sister. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Saru, for your donation and support. And we need more sisters and brothers to click on that button and donate, because, you know, her research and her work is of the utmost importance, and we must, support her. We cannot, sit back and say what we don't have. We have researchers and scholars and everything, but they need support. Definitely need support. All right, let me go look at the switchboard. We have area code 720. Could you let us know who you are and where you're calling from? All right, let me try that again. Area code 720. Could you let us know who you are and where you're calling from?
This is Brother Commit in Denver, Colorado.
Greetings, Brother Commit.
I just have a question. Greetings, sisters. Great show. I'm glad to hear about the primary research type of work that you're doing. I am familiar with Manu and Pim. Met him years ago at a conference in Chicago, and you guys are on it with the primary research. And by not being too extreme in one area or the other, I appreciate that.
Thank you.
My question is, have you come across any research, primary or otherwise, dealing with Nubia, that has any connections with some of the archaeology in America?
Well, I used to work at museums, and there's an Egyptian burial that took place from in Detroit, because Detroit is part of the Mound culture complex. And, yes, there's a connection. There's a connection with ancient Nubia, with the area, what we would call Cancun. There's a connection with ancient Nubia with possibly the Olmec civilization. So the Nubian sailors were sailing around the world, it appears. It's not academia hasn't embraced it yet, but there is evidence that some of the things that they were talking about that existed in ancient Nubia was actually part of different places that they had occupied in different places of the world. The same culture exists several different places. Yeah, I have found it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that answer. I have one more question, mm-hmm. and I'll be off the line and continue listening. The other question is, are you familiar with Horace Butler, When Rocks Cry Out, that work? And can you mention some other works that you do respect?
Mm-hmm. Horace Butler's work, When Rocks Cry Out, is not a scientific study. It's just a person who has noticed some similarities, and a friend of mine actually lives there, and she says, the rocks are crying out because the rocks have pictures on them and they have stories and stuff like that. So the work that I respect, of course, is of Ivan Van Sertima, Black Women in Antiquity, the book Mami Wata by Mama Zogby, Wayne B. Chandler, Ancient Future, many, many books that I really, really respect. I could go give you a thorough list. The Isis Papers, of course, by Dr. Francis Press Welsing, The Peculiar Institution by Kenneth M. Stamp, that kind of, brings kind of a, gives you some borders, what happened as things came across this side of everything. African Mythology by Paul Hamlin, many, many, many different books, but those are the main ones that I refer to probably on a daily basis to museums and archaeology in West Africa. On a daily basis, when I'm going through my work, I kind of go around and try to get a balanced perspective on things, those are the resources. And then there are more. There are many, 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 many more.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for calling.
Before you get off the line, there were two other books that are mentioned in the chat room. One is The Snake Goddess, and another one is They Came Before Adam. I know specifically
right.
They Came Before Adam is by Catherine Acholon.
Catherine Acholon.
Right.
Motherism by Catherine Antonello, too. Motherism by Catherine Antonello.
Okay, that sounds great. I appreciate it, ladies, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, brother.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I got about 15 more minutes.
Right. I know you have a very important event you have to head out to. So if there are any more comments or questions, now's the time to call in 646-716-7675. Also, do go to ancientnubiancities.com and press the donate button and make a donation, and or press the button to purchase the DVD In Search of the Creatress. And someone sent me a little memo a couple moments ago saying they had tried to donate and they had a problem with the link. So
did they press on the image? Because I have it up right now. Did they press on the image to do the donate button?
Not sure. They didn't say. They just said they tried to donate and.
I'm clicking
on the actual donate button where it says the donate PayPal button, the one that says donate, and that one takes me right to right here. So it seems to be working.
Okay. Go to the ancientnubiancities.com and then click on the image. You'll see the image of my logo, the Nubian people, this little square image that looks kind of like a stamp on the right, and it says click the image, and then that it will get you there.
Right, that's for the DVD, correct?
That's for the DVD, but you can just press in. If you just want to press in and do a donation, just press it as many times as you want to, or just send a donation in. If you're one of those people who doesn't have doesn't have internet access, you can also send a donation in to the Nubian Archaeological Project, a check. You can send it in to Insorma Institute, in care of the Nubian Archaeological Project. That's Insorma, N-S-O-R-O-M-A, Insorma Institute. And the address there at Insorma Institute is, I think it's 20, let me get this exactly right because I don't want any problems with that. The mailing address in Sora Institute is 20045 Joanne Street, Detroit, Michigan, 48205. That's 20045 Joanne Street, Detroit, Michigan, 48205. And you can send a check there. You can also call me if you need some other way to, or you're having trouble with the donate button. At 313-454-3150. That's 313-454-3150. And, and ask me a question right there. Because the donate button there is probably will only do $20 increments. If you have less and you just want to send a check, go ahead and send it to the Joanne Street address. I really, really appreciate anything that you can do. And so I'm not requiring you if you just don't have $20 and you just want to support. It's whatever you can or if you can, and just support the project, even by word of mouth, telling other people, that's our greatest support as well.
All right. Okay, we have another person with a question. Let me see if I can open up that line. Area code 786, could you let us know who you are and where you're calling from?
The 786?
Yes.
786, yes.
Divine greetings. How are the Netflixes doing today? This is IT Blues, calling from South Florida. I wanted to know if you came across any, there was a book put out by a brother where it was saying, I think it was called Orima, where it's talking about how even in the ancient days, that the actual pharaohs were women and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know in your research, did you come across anything that can support that?
That the oracles from Europe were women? Is that what you're saying?
That the Sutans, the pharaohs, were actually women and not men.
I haven't seen that, but there. I mean, some of the pharaohs were. Well, you know, as everybody knows, Sethepshet. If I can get her name right.
Hatshepsut.
Yeah, there's quite a tongue twister to me. We know that she was a woman, to wore total pharaoh regalia, but I haven't come across that as yet. I know Amenhotep is thought, because he has that curvaceous shape, that he's a woman. I think that he's given because he's going back. You know, they say that he's going back to that Nubian concept of God being worshipped to a woman. That dynasty went back to that thought. So I think he's pretty much stylized himself to give divinity and credence to the woman as being divine. So no, I haven't read that book at all. So that's one that I'm writing down.
Okay. On this station with Nas, who's the author of Warhima. That was an interview that I can't give you the date. I believe that interview was either in 2000, I think it was 2010. I did an interview with him. I have to get the title of it, but if they look back in my archives on Black Womaniverse Radio Show, they can listen to the interview with the author if they want some more information regarding that book.
Mm-hmm.
Or contact the author. He's also on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What is his name?
Warhima. Okay, that's the name of the book. His name is Naj, N-A-J. I'll send you the information.
Thank you, brother. Oh, definitely, no problem. You know, I'm definitely spread the word about you. I'm just coming into the fold of you. You know, I do spoken word poetry, so, you know, that's my forte, to share the word and everything like that. So it's a beautiful new day.
All right. Thank you, brother.
Thank you for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. All right, we have a few more minutes before we, get ready to close up so Nubia can go to her. I believe you have a fundraiser or an event in Detroit. Did you want to give that information out in case there are any listeners in Detroit?
Sure, the fundraiser in Detroit. It's an event, In Search of the Creatress, a lecture that I'm giving in Detroit, is at 19011 Livernois Avenue, south of 7 Mile, and it begins at 5 p.m. 5 p.m., if you get there between 5 and 5:30, should be fine, because usually I just try to wait till, you know, at least a few people come in. If you need any more information, you can call me at 313-454-3150. There's a $10 donation at the door, and I hope that you can come out. It's just the support is beautiful. I mean, the energy is just beautiful that people are interested in supporting me. And Tara, I have to thank you again and again and again for your assistance as well.
Not a problem at all. You're very welcome. And if I'm looking in the chat room, if there are people who may be having problems with the donate link for some reason, try it in a different browser. I'm using Mozilla Firefox, and everything is working fine for me. But, again, if you are having problems, she gave her phone number, 313-454-3150, and the address for Informa Institute, you know, care of Nubian Archaeological Project, 20045 Joanne Street, Detroit, Michigan, 48205, in case you want to mail in a donation. What is your email address? Because some people that have PayPal accounts, they can just go into PayPal and send you money to that email address for your PayPal account.
Right. My PayPal account, my email is NubianDigs, NubianDigz, at yahoo.com. NubianDigz at yahoo.com. So that will work as well. We have any more questions, Sister Tar?
I do not. I just want to thank everyone who participated in our live broadcast of the telethon, but this will definitely continue. One more person popped up on the switchboard. I'm going to see if I can get their question. But even after this goes, you know, off stream in the archives. If you're listening to this in archive, it is still not too late to make a donation. She will be over there from September to January, if I'm not mistaken. So all throughout the time frame.
September to May, actually.
Wow, mm-hmm. September to May. So anytime that you decide to do a donation is perfectly fine. If you want to step up and make a monthly, you know, a donation every month in support of, that can be done too by clicking the donate button or using the information that we have shared during this show so that she can have continued support, because that's another thing that we definitely need, continued support. The one-time donations are fine, but if you want to give, say, $150 or $200, but you want to spread it out, you can do that. So those are options, and the excuse that we don't have it is definitely not, we have it. We just need to allot it to where the funding needs to go. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and open up this last line so we can get a comment or question in from a caller, 816 area code. Could you let us know who you are and where you're calling from?
Hey, peace, sisters. My name is Sharp Warren, calling from Kansas City, Missouri. I got in kind of late, so I needed information, phone number, and your website.
Okay. My phone number is 313-454-3150. That's 313-454-3150. My website is www.ancientnubiancities.com. My email address is nubiandigs, NUBIANDIGZ, at yahoo.com. And, you know, that's good contact information. Mailing address is Nsorama Institute, N-S-O-R-O Institute, and N-S-O-R-O-M-A, excuse me, Institute, and Care of Nubian Archaeological Project, 20045 Joanne Street, Detroit, Michigan, 48205.
All right, beautiful, beautiful. I got it.
Thank
okay,
you, brother.
I commend you on your work also.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, and Anubia, right before you go, if you could just take two more seconds and speak about the connection between Cancun and Yucatan and Africa, because there are a lot of connections there. I've been to that place before myself, and I have an upcoming retreat coming up next year for women who are interested in going to that area. Could you just speak on that for a moment?
Yucatan Peninsula. Well, there are a lot of connections. For the one thing, there are burials where in Egypt that contain the coca leaf that did not grow anywhere in that area, and there are burials in Cancun that have curry on the inside of their burials. So there was some type of cultural exchange. And those two items coming from both of those places, there are pictures of elephants in that area of the world, which we know were not in that area of the world, possibly coming over from Africa. There are also the pyramids are the priestesses. The women were the keeper of the culture and the priestesses in that area. Some things we believe in coming from Egypt, ancient Nubia, because remember, at a certain point in history, they were joined, they were unified, so there was pretty much no difference. It was part of the Egyptian Empire. You get that going there. There are pyramids in that area. There are many temples that are shaped in the alligator being the child of Neith, in the form of a woman. We have all kinds of when you go to the whales, and they said that they dredged the whale, there were offerings of gold bracelets and things like that, silver bracelets, gold bracelets to the deities. There were human sacrifices in that area. We don't see that much in ancient Nubia and ancient Kemet, even in the oldest known record keeping. But the area has pyramids. They have priestess temples, and in the women are very, very high in ranking in that society. It seems to be pretty much an egalitarian society in that area. That's about all I can say about it, as you know, Tara. But there are some other things.
Okay.
I mean, the book Horace Butler, When rocks cry out, it poses a lot of different questions. They came before Columbus, of course, by Ivan Vincertima. Is a book, if you have not got that book, that book is still relevant, talking about how Africans visited the Americas and Central America and that area too. And as I said, there is definitely an Egyptian burial here in the Detroit area from the Maung culture, which, you know, to me it says more that people were mobile and people were traveling around more than 3,000 years ago. People weren't just landlocked and could not go to boats and do research and sail around the world and contribute to other cultures as well as establish colonies and other different places, because that's what an empire does. That's what the United States does. That's what Britain does. I call it not so great Britain does. That's just what people do when they establish military power and economic power. They're able to spread out and spread their empire to the seven corners of the world. So I think that the Africans were doing that a long time ago, and not to mention that, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. The colors of the royal colors for ancient Egypt were red, white, and blue. And so this stuff has been modeled before, and it's the blueprint for civilization coming right from Kemet and ancient Nubia.
All right. Well, again, thank you for everything that you have shared with us and for everything that you are doing and will continue to do. Again, I urge everyone to click on that donate button on ancientnubiancities.com and or send a donation to Nubian Digs with a Z at yahoo.com to support the Nubian Archaeological Project. Thank you for coming on today, and I will talk to you later, sis.
All right. Thank you for having me, and thank you for all the guests that are listening. Okay. Peace and blessings. Bye-bye.
All right. Just a couple of other announcements before we end the show out for today. I want to thank everyone who is listening, everyone, again, who has made a donation to support Nubian Archaeological Project and for the donations that will be forthcoming. I thank you in advance for those, because it does help to get the word out. So share the link, share the information about the radio show with as many people as possible so that we can get funding for the Nubian Archaeological Project. Anyone who is interested in, as I mentioned earlier, there will be a retreat. It's going to be a second annual Black Womaniverse retreat where we will be visiting the area that Nubia Warford just finished speaking about in the Yucatan, and visiting some of these archaeological sites, as well as having a little bit of, you know, sister time and having a little bit of fun. So if you're interested in that retreat, you can look it up on Facebook. It is under Second Annual Black Women's Cultural Retreat, or you can just look up Black Womaniverse on Facebook and check out our events. So if anyone does not have any further questions or comments, we are done for the day, but make sure that you go and you click on that donate button to help out Sister Nubia Warford. With that being said, y'all have a great day, and peace and blessings.
From the light, seeking refuge in the dark. She's a lock from the ark, spitting lyrics from the heart. Honey complected it, brainwaves stay connected it. Her meditation skills keep her traveling through the stars. Came from the ether, destination unknown, blown from out the space where by the ancient people were grown. Shown the truth since the youth, and the roots showed the proof. Opening pathways like the Father Eshu. Like that boot camp sheet, a strange wonder. Ascended to the heavens from the land of down under. Trying to figure how to reunite her people now asunder. She devoured seasoned lions to save off her growing hunger. Her number, the two stands forever growing with them. She is the moon, he the sun, over sand and make the cycle one. You could catch a politicking on the streets of Mecca. Did she rest in Elay Ether to recharge her bio essence?
81 is when she broke the earthly terrain. Born with two Fulani earrings and a pocket full of chains. Touch with a voice that's the sound to behold. She broke the mold, renewed the old, turned the microphone to solid gold. Spoke with the elders before she left the home planet, and they told her never disrespect the craft if you can stand it. Remember the four facets, they will carry you far. Not for you to be a star, but a preserver of art. Part human cause the body she inhabits. A goddess cause she carries bloodlines of the immortal status. Like Gladys, took them in that train to Georgia, sticking out the ground like old Moorish explorers. The forest of knowledge was barren and weeds were taking over. She took the seed from her magic bag and planted near a 40 clover. A lotus flower grew from mud at the riverbank. The people start rejoicing, knowing they knew he was giving thanks.